The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
In the lengthening days of March, the Germans extended their attacks to the west bank of the Meuse and to a hill with the sinister name of Mortum, Dead Man.
Poison gas, the supreme terror of the First World War.
None of these innocent men could have imagined the horrors that beckoned, the nightmare of life in the trenches.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. This conflict started August 2nd.
This is the road to Basra. The Iraqi army jammed this highway and other roads as coalition ground forces moved into Kuwait.
On March 20th, 2003, thousands of troops of the U.S.-led coalition began to pour across Kuwait's border with Iraq and head towards Baghdad. Within 20 days, they had arrived in the capital and broken Saddam Hussein's regime.
It's been a century since the outbreak of the first truly global war. We'll be returning to the First World War itself at a later date, but in this podcast we'll be looking at two novels published exactly 100 years apart, both of which are powered by the century of fear and bloodshed that lies between them. Willy Vallotin's The Free finds a group of characters dealing with the fallout of war and economic depression in a small American town in the present day.
It's 6 o'clock the next morning. He left the group home and drove to his house. Even in the freezing cold, the smell of the plants drifted up from the basement. Would the smell travel? Would his neighbors smell it? He'd been avoiding them for almost 2 years since his wife and daughters left. What did they think of him now? And if they smelled the marijuana, would they know what it was? Mr. and Mrs. Hughes were old, and they didn't worry him, but the Jacksons weren't. Richard Jackson worked for the fire department. Maybe he suspected something already. He started the shower and turned on the box heater. He put his paint store clothes next to it, set the kitchen timer for 10 minutes, and got in. He stood under the hot water, and he looked at the old white shower tile and remembered his grandfather installing it. His grandfather smoking a cigarillo with his greased back hair, making sure each line was straight. He'd been a perfectionist. It was his bathroom. It was his house. And now Freddie was losing it. He dressed and drove to Heaven Doors Donut and parked. He walked inside to see Maura leaning against the glass counter in red sweats and a white apron. She was watching the news on a portable TV that sat on a shelf in the corner of the room. "Hey, you're 10 minutes early," she said. "Dale was on time for a change," Freddie said. Maura moved her large body back and bent down and sighed from the effort. She took 5 donut holes from the lowest shelf, put them in a plastic basket, and set it in front of him. She poured him a half a cup of coffee. Freddie drank from it and took an old hockey puck from his coat pocket and set it on the counter. "I was looking through some boxes last night, and I found this. It's from the 82 season when the Winterhawks won the WHL championship. I'm not sure what game it's from, but there's writing on it. It's my dad's handwriting. It says 82 Hawks. It's my after Christmas present to you." Maura picked it up, flipped it over, and read the writing. She grabbed his hand and squeezed it. "Thank you," she said. "Maybe it's from the championship game." "Maybe," he said. "Let's just say it is," she said. "All right." She took her purse from the shelf below the register, put the puck inside, and leaned down on the counter again. "You look really beat this morning, Freddie." "I know. But I'm okay," he said. "Are you sure?" "Maybe you should go to a doctor." "I'm okay, really." He ate a donut hole and washed it down with coffee. "Did you get a chance to talk to Ginny and Kathleen last night?" "I did, and I did what you told me and wrote down a list of questions. That seemed to work better." We were on the phone twice as long that way, but you can tell they get bored. Kids have no attention spans. You know that. Freddy picked up another donut hole, but set it down. He looked at Maura, and suddenly tears flooded in his eyes. He couldn't explain why it happened right then, but he began to sob in front of her. "What's wrong, Freddy?" she asked. He stared at the rows of donuts below the glass counter. He leaned across to her and whispered, "I can't keep going like this." Maura reached over and put her hand on his arm. "I know," she said. "How could you?" "I'm sorry," he whispered and wiped his eyes. "Don't be sorry. It's okay," she told him. "Tell me, what's going on, Freddy?" When he finally spoke, his voice was raw and so quiet it was barely audible. He couldn't even look at her when he spoke. "I keep making bad decisions. Why are all my decisions so bad? I'm going to lose everything." He wiped his eyes on his coat sleeves, "and I've failed everybody." "Ah, Freddy, don't say that," Maura said. "But it's true." "It's not. You've known me here for, what, 13 years, right?" Freddy nodded. "Think of all the nice things you've done for me. When Raymond left me, you'd come in here every morning, and you could tell just by looking at me that I needed help. I didn't even have to say anything, and you'd invite me over for dinner. Your family took care of me. You listened to me, Freddy, and no one listens to me. You made me want to keep going when I didn't want to. So don't say you're a failure. You've never failed me, Freddy." She walked out from behind the counter and went to him and put her arms around him. She smelled of donuts and soap, and she was soft and warm. He collapsed into her and closed his eyes as two white work vans pulled up in front of the donut shop with their headlights shining in on them.
Willie, that is Freddy, who is one of two central characters in The Free, who works by night in a care home, by day in a builder supply merchant, and is going down the pan.
I wrote him in a certain way as almost a symbol of the working class guy who doesn't give up, and he just keeps working, even though his working conditions get worse. He tries as hard as he can, gets a second job, because he's trying to keep his house, really, and kind of his stature is a man that owns a house. And he knows he's unable to do that, but he just can't quit trying.
So on the one hand, you have these small acts of kindness. And then on the other hand, you have the misfortune that propels Freddy and people like him out of safety. And the misfortune in his case was the medical bills of his small daughter.
He has a daughter that's born with severe disabilities. And he has a health plan, but it's not a very good one. And they spend, you know, all their savings and they mortgage their house to fly to see specialists. His wife has to quit her job. And like happens so often when there's a great trauma in a family, the couple starts fighting and they don't get along. And so I think Freddie, like most people, when your back's against the wall, little acts of kindness, maybe a donut, maybe your neighbor being nice to you, can, you know, just shift you enough to get you through the day and make you feel more optimistic than pessimistic.
The other character, central character, is a nurse called Pauline, who is a very kind person as well. But she's also struggling with quite a difficult life. She's by herself. She has a really cantankerous father who's dependent on her.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in nurses, and I've always wanted to write, before I died, one great nurse story, because nurses have always been nice to me. I have a friend that's a nurse, and she is just one of those people that you can tell anything to, and she just understands. My interest in Pauline is in one section is because she's a nurse. And the second was, you know, her father is kind of manic depressive and he's a really tricky guy to live with. And she's had to build a maze of walls around herself to protect herself from him. She keeps isolating herself to the point where she lives a very solitary, safe life, but she's kind of losing her humanity. And I think she knows that. And her one Achilles heel is she brings her patients home with her sometimes. And she has a patient that's a kid that reminds her a lot of herself. And she falls for the kid. The kid kind of jumps over all her walls. And so Pauline tries to save her. But in trying to save her, she kind of reclaims, you know, part of her humanity. You know, she breaks down her own walls a little bit and kind of becomes a better person, I think.
Freddie also breaks boundaries, doesn't he? Because he pursues to hospital an Iraq veteran who was in the home he takes care of in the night and tried to commit suicide and is in this semi-comatose state.
Yeah, the other real main character in the novel is Leroy. He was a National Guard guy, just an electrician over in Iraq, and he got a brain injury. And my ideas with him were really just reading so many stories about brain injuries. I thought it was, in a way, the cruelest trick to come home, maybe with your body intact, but your mind is shattered, and you just can't control your emotions. So there's deep, deep spells of despair.
Leroy Curvin had been 24 years old when his National Guard Brigade was sent to Iraq. 6 months into the deployment, a roadside bomb had destroyed the vehicle he was in. One soldier had been killed, two others severely injured, and he'd woken up in a hospital in Germany with major brain trauma and two broken arms. He couldn't speak, and he couldn't walk. The life he'd known before the bomb no longer existed. That Leroy Curvin had vanished. The new Leroy Curvin couldn't recognize people he had just met. He would become instantly agitated and just as quickly depressed. He'd throw things in frustration 1 minute and sob the next. It took him months to relearn to walk, months before he could again hold a fork, and always he struggled with his speech and with his emotions. There was no miraculous recovery for the new Leroy Curvin. Rehabilitation turned into caregiving, and eventually led him to a second-rate group home for disabled men in a town in Washington State. But that night, for the first time since the explosion, he woke with clarity. Memories flooded into him. He could recall his routines, the week's menu, what time he went to bed, and which days he took a shower. He could remember his mother bringing him takeout food and sitting next to him while they watched TV. He could remember his girlfriend, her eyes and face, and the birthmark on her calf and her walking around in her underwear. He could suddenly recall the way she laughed, the sound of her voice when she was upset, the way she sneezed, and the way she sighed sadly when the alarm went off in the morning. What was happening to him? Time passed and he didn't know what to do. He grew tired. He could hear the kid Raleigh in the next room jacking off, and the old man Hal snoring faintly in the room across the hall. Farther down, he could hear Donald having a coughing attack. Donald, who would run around the place naked, who would come into Leroy's room, shake him awake, and spit unintelligible words all over his face. If he fell asleep, would he wake up lost and in the fog again? Would the clarity be gone? Would he have to spend the rest of his life there? He remembered suddenly the long months when every time he closed his eyes, it felt like he was drowning in mud. And then there were periods when his thoughts fell into nothing but frustration and violence. How days would pass when every time he heard a door shut or open, he felt certain someone was coming to kill him. The fear of that would engulf him, and when the fear passed, the fog would again come, and he wouldn't be able to remember anything. It would just start over. Was this all his life was? Was this clarity just another illusion, a trick? He knew that most likely he would close his eyes and sleep would come, and the clarity would disappear, and the frustration, the bleak thoughts, and the fog would return. But at that moment, on that night, he had a window, and he decided to escape through it. He decided he would kill himself.
So with Leroy, what I was trying to say was, like, he knows he's in a bad situation, and he's stuck. He's got no choices, so he decides to disappear into his mind, and all he wants to do is disappear with his girlfriend. And his girlfriend, all she ever wanted to do was go up the Canadian coast. And so he thinks he's going to disappear into this kind of sci-fi world with his girl and live happily ever after. But his mind won't let him. His version of hell is the free, the idea of who's a real American, and that kind of right-wing, hawkish nature of a certain side of America that's really kind of frightening to me. He suddenly gets in a world that is drowning in those ideas, and he can't escape it. And
because he's marked. They're in his fantasy, they're physically marked. The people who are seen to be cowardly by the free and therefore have to be exterminated.
Yeah, when I grew up in my house, it was all like, who's a real American, you know, and are you a hippie? And it was really right-wing. I don't mind the discussion between the left and the right. I always thought you need the environmentalist and the businessman to figure it out. So, you know, because everybody needs nature and everybody needs jobs. And just comments like that in my house was seen that I was, you know, nearly a communist traitor. You didn't get literally beat up, but, you know, you got put in your place pretty fast.
How much did you set out to write a State of the Nation novel?
Yes, I figured at least once in my life I have to try to stand up, and these were all issues that I felt really strong about. You know, my girlfriend switched jobs and was unable to get health insurance, and she's a 42-year-old woman, and once you're, like, in your 40s and you don't have health insurance, I mean, it's really scary. And if you don't get a job that has a health plan, we just couldn't get one on our own. And you know, we own a house, and you could lose everything if she got sick. And it's expensive to get sick in the U.S. And so I was really worried about that. And I had a friend of mine's kid was born with severe disabilities, and he didn't have the money to deal with it. And his, you know, marriage suffered, and it's, you know, the trauma of it. So they were all issues that I knew about, and I felt at least once in my life I got to, you know, be tough enough to try to write something with such broad and heated themes, you know.
This is your fourth novel. Mm-hmm. You've been described as a romantic realist. But what is distinctive about this novel is that it does have this science fiction strand, which is written in italics, which is a sort of science fiction fantasy, which is part of the story, but you can read it almost as a story in its own right. To what extent are you challenging the idea of yourself as a romantic realist?
You know, as a kid, I got through, you know, life living in a false reality. I'd make, you know, if I wanted a good dad, I just made one up, and I made him, he was great. I lived in long extended daydreams where I lived in on a wrecking yard, parting out cars with my uncle, and we would just like go out to eat and go see movies and work on cars. And I would live there while I was in class, and I would live there when I was having a hard time. Like with Leroy, I just felt so bad for the guy that I figured that what I would do is try to disappear. And he's a science fiction buff. And I figured he would try to disappear with her and it'd be this kind of romantic journey. I like writing romantic stuff because everybody likes romance. You know, everybody wants to be loved or find somebody they love. But the science fiction element of it, besides giving me a little break from the, you know, the intensity of this novel, it also gave me the freedom to talk more about like politics in a way that I thought would be interesting or fun for me to talk about.
And your other life, is it another life or is it part of the same life? Is as part of the band Richmond Fontaine?
You know, my brother convinced me or encouraged me to write songs when I was 13. I wrote songs obsessively until I was 20, and then I discovered the great Australian songwriter Paul Kelly. And Paul Kelly, at the time, wrote a song based on a Raymond Carver short story. And when I read him, it opened my eyes to the fact that you didn't have to be, a Rhodes Scholar to write novels. You didn't have to be a spy or, been a submarine captain or some great man. You could just be a guy hanging on by the skin of your teeth. And those stories are important, too. And those were the stories that I really enjoyed. Those were the stories, even as a kid, I wanted to read about guys like me, you know, and I wanted to read, like, that's why Steinbeck was such a hero of mine. I just understood his heart, I felt. And so I started writing novels from 21 on. And then, you know, the music, I just had always been in a band. So I just kind of kept being in a band, but really the work ethic of writing novels, the grind of it is the thing I enjoy the most. Putting in the hours and the tinkering of it is the funnest thing in the world for me. I don't tour as much because I like writing. In the band, the one reason we're still together, because we've been together almost 20 years, is because we all don't like touring very much. So the price you pay for not touring a lot is you can't make a full-time living at it the way we do it.
Well, the irony of it is you're now on a book tour, but you have got your guitar with you. So would you give us a sense of your music, please?
Sure, of course. This is a song by Richmond Fontaine called 43. And it was kind of the first song that I wrote thinking about the ideas of who became Freddie in The Free. The story is a little bit different than how Freddie turns out in The Free, but the heart of it and the ideas are the same. Angry little folk song.
He was 43 years old, paying for his mother to be in a home, paying his ex-wife and kids in a different state. He worked at a paint store. He mortgaged his home. He was going broke. He was going broke. He started growing weed 80 plants and more. The home got off his back, so did the ex-wife, even though she was living with a cop. He'd get drunk and he wouldn't leave her alone. She started calling, begging for more money so she could get out on her own. Get out on her own.
Willie Verlauten, a multi-talented novelist and songwriter. His latest book, The Free, is published by Faber, and his band, Richmond Fontaine, have their own website on the internet. Now, let's go back 100 years. H.G. Wells' The World Set Free speculates, with terrifying accuracy in some respects, about the course that 20th century warfare would take. Here's a passage from its opening chapter.
The problem, which was already being mooted by such scientific men as Ramsay, Rutherford and Soddy in the very beginning of the 20th century, the problem of inducing radioactivity in the heavier elements and so tapping the internal energy of atoms, was solved by a wonderful combination of induction, intuition and luck by Holston so soon as the year 1933. From the first detection of radioactivity to its first subjugation to human purpose measured little more than a quarter of a century. For 20 years after that, indeed, minor difficulties prevented any striking practical application of his success. But the essential thing was done. This new boundary in the march of human progress was crossed in that year. He set up atomic disintegration in a minute particle of bismuth. It exploded with great violence into a heavy gas of extreme radioactivity, which disintegrated in its turn in the course of 7 days. And it was only after another year's work that he was able to show practically that the last result of this rapid release of energy was gold. But the thing was done at the cost of a blistered chest and an injured finger, and from the moment when the invisible speck of bismuth flashed into the writhing and rending energy, Holston knew that he had opened a way for mankind, however narrow and dark it might still be, to worlds of limitless power.
That was H.G. Wells speculating in 1914 about the splitting of the atom. With me in the studio to discuss the book are Michael Sherborne, Wells' biographer, and Graham Farmelow, whose recent book, Churchill's Bomb, brought this extraordinary literary prophecy to our attention in the first place. Michael, tell us about The World Set Free. I said it with astonishing accuracy. It's obviously accurate in some parts, i.e. it happened, but it's inaccurate in other parts.
Yes, I think the accuracy is not only the atom bomb, it's also the forecast of the war itself. Wells foresaw a global war that would draw a line through the history of civilization, would demoralise the soldiers, would affect the civilians badly as well, and would end in a huge peace conference creating an international body. So I think he was very accurate in that. Obviously, his idea of an atom bomb was ahead of its time, and he saw it as a kind of grenade. The idea is that the Argonauts of the air lob it out of their aircraft, it hits the ground and explodes for a few months, which is quite different from the actual atom bomb. Mm.
But he, at the cost of a blistered chest and an injured finger, if only.
Well, he was thinking of Marie Curie, I guess, and the radiation, you know, so he was thinking the guy might get off fairly lightly with the radiation.
Graham, how important is this book?
For me, as a renegade physicist, what's remarkable is that Wells was so far ahead of his time in identifying the disruptive possibilities of what we now call nuclear energy. I mean, if you look at the time he wrote this book, 1913, we only just knew about the atomic nucleus. That's the tiny, tiny core at the centre of every atom. And it was only just becoming clear that that was a seat of a huge amount of energy relative to normal processes. What Wells did, just after reading a book by Frederick Soddy, one of the pioneers of this subject, was to take a single line, pretty much, of page 5 of that book, where Soddy says this is a huge amount of energy that we can tap. And from that tiny little thread, Wells wove this astonishing prophecy, so to speak. Maybe that's putting it a bit too strong, but this astonishingly imaginative vision of the future. And that was something that physicists, chemists, scientists at that time were in awe of. Not as Wells the scientist, but the person who could take a small part of science and extrapolate it way into the future.
Michael, what he foresaw was hugely influential, wasn't it? I mean, not only in this, but he wrote other prophetic pieces, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, Shape of Things to Come, First Men in the Moon, all those books, yes. And a lot of his non-fictional books too.
Such as the Anticipations of the Reaction of Mechanical and Scientific Progress upon Human Life and Thought.
That's the longer title. Yes. In that book, actually, he forecasts the European Union, Union of European Countries, centred on the Rhine. And he says there may have to be some wars before Germany joins in. And he says that maybe the British will find it hard to stay in because of their links to the USA. So that's pretty good.
You don't think very highly of it?
No, not as a... No, I think, to be fair to Wells, it wasn't meant for posterity. It's meant to be a piece of stimulating journalism for its day.
It reminds me a bit of 2001 Space Odyssey, the way it's written.
I think so, yes. The opening with the ape men looking up at the sun, wanting to capture it. And he then produces an entire theory of where fiction comes from. It's the aspiration to achieve, you know, through daydreams. And then at the end, you have this character, Karenin, theorising about how man has to be reborn and lose gender and go into a new body and learn to breathe in space, which again is very like the ending of 2001. But I'm sure Arthur C. Clarke had read the book.
It's actually about technology, really, isn't it? And mankind's ability to harness it.
Yes. I mean, the book is in the tradition of a literature about humans getting more and more powerful weapons that are moving further and further away from their control. And with typical Wells' imagination, he realises there's one way in which the thing could be, what does he call it, a hell bomb or something like this. Something where one's explosive capability is so colossal that human beings draw a line and say, well, we can't. Cannot continue down this route. And of course, I would say, predictably, in Wells' case, he then finds it a reason for humankind at last to go down the kind of trajectory he wanted to see it go down.
Oh, that's absolutely correct, yes. It's quite a propagandist book by the time we get to the end.
What he did foresee, with almost a comic accuracy, was the idea that you could actually induce radioactivity. Radioactivity had been discovered in 1896 in Paris. And this was the idea that some elements could fall apart, so to speak, and form other elements releasing energy. It's seen as a very mysterious, frightening thing, something that Wells tapped into very well. What we didn't know was that you could actually make some element radioactive. And he foresaw that as happening in 1933. And blow me down, when does it happen? Pretty much that year. You know, Wells's ability to put his finger on this was, I have to say, quite remarkable.
I think Wells was quite embarrassed he'd set the book in 1956 rather than 1914.
Well, I think this doesn't it undermine slightly this foreseeing the war that you were talking about, Mike?
Well, no, I think he got the war right. What he said was he pushed it back a bit because he didn't think they'd be able to split the atom as soon as that. So he wanted to put the atom bomb in the war, and therefore he put the war back 30, 40 years in order to allow for that to happen.
Yeah. So when he was writing it, he didn't have a sense of imminent war then?
I think he was aware it was coming, but he was still shocked when it arrived. It's one thing to think of it, one thing to have it actually happen.
Well, when the book came out in the States, he was regarded by his publishers, and it was advertised as the great imaginator. And likewise, Churchill was someone who read Wells avidly. He said he read all his books twice, not once, but twice. And he gave credit to Wells as being someone who foresaw the cataclysm coming. And yet, in terms of the dropping of the first atomic bomb, that happened, of course, in 1945.
So what was his impact? We said it's not a great novel. Why are we talking about it now?
This was the first person, scientist or non-scientist, who saw clearly the possible impact of harnessing nuclear energy. Right, something we live with now. Wells foresaw in this novel civil nuclear power in 1953, and that was within, 18 months of the first switch-on of nuclear reactors for commercial use. So although not the finest work of literature, it is a wonderful token of his farsightedness as a thinker and as a writer.
Perhaps we should say, at the end of the book, we have this idea of the redemption of the human race by kind of modifying this surgically. I suppose that's something we have got to look forward to, isn't it? The genetic modification of the human being.
Yeah. And also, he's very good at picking up these scents. So one of them was that when power became so abundant, it could look forward to an age where humans have a great deal more leisure. And I mean serious amounts of leisure. And his old fan Churchill, when Churchill left office, he was echoing just those sentiments down in Chartwell, right, because he, as I said, was a devotee of Wells, and he was wondering why aren't human beings taking a further advantage of this new abundance of power. Now, of course, we know things are much more complicated, you know, with radioactive waste disposal and goodness knows what, and of course the problem of looking after atomic weapons and their spread to agencies that that might not deal with them in a responsible way. I mean, all these things are in there in Wells's novel.
Should we mention, say, Leo Szilard in here? I'm sure you know more about most of us, but Szilard was the man who devised the chain reaction, is that right?
He did. He was, by his own account at least, was the first person to conceive of a nuclear chain reaction, which means you could have a whole series of nuclear reactions which release that energy, which is the mechanism behind the first atomic bomb.
Szilard had read The World Set Free. Therefore, by his own account anyway, he buried the patent in the Admiralty Office so it wouldn't be found by anybody, because he was scared of what would happen if it was put into practice. Then when the Second World War started, he went to the authorities and said, look, I think you need to get this atom bomb going, and so that all came out of what he knew from Wells.
You're right, Szilard was very much influenced by Wells, and when Szilard went to Los Alamos, he put a copy of The World Set Free in the library, and the library Oppenheimer & Co. had set up. So who knows who read that among the scientists and indeed their close family. Yes. You know, one thing that that's always interested me was that I think Wells actually longed to be respected as a scientist.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
He eventually got his PhD during the Second World War. I think it was in genetics, Mike, wasn't it?
Well, it was a rather odd thing if you read the summary of it. I mean, it's really a religious thesis almost, as you would expect with Wells, about the difference, well, the relationship between the individual and the species. Mm-hmm. But it was uses a lot of biological terminology. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think Wells was always a bit ashamed he became an author. I think he wanted to be a scientist, or rather, looking back on it, he'd rather have been a scientist. And to some degree, he sabotaged his writing career as time went on, I think, and wrote more and more in a kind of pseudo-scientific vein in order to try and reposition himself with posterity, which is perhaps a mistake.
We mustn't forget that Wells had some very classy admirers, Joseph Conrad, Henry James, and even James Joyce.
Yes, I think very much so. And in a way, once Wells had fallen out with James and they had taken opposite positions on the novel, then I think Wells produced books like The World Set Free as a kind of anti-novel, really. He'd given up on doing what James did. He said, well, you can do that. You've conquered that territory. I'm going to write different kind of novels. I'm going to mix up articles and dialogue and war story and prophetic inspirational monologue and make a new kind of book out of it. It doesn't actually work, but you know, that was his idea, really, I think, to write a different kind of book. Mm-hmm. Maybe a book that wouldn't last down the centuries, but would do something exciting at the time he wrote it.
I always thought it was a little bit of a shame that the Royal Society didn't make him a fellow. You know, they've got this little clause where they can bring in people. Of course, they brought in Churchill, who arguably perhaps deserved it slightly less than Wells, but he never actually got that honour.
Well, his son did, so he got something out of it.
Oh, he did? I think
George Philip Wells got to be FRS. I think so.
H.G. Wells, Another Kind of Life by Michael Sherburn is published by Peter Owen, and Churchill's Bomb by Graham Farmelow is published by Faber. Thanks to both of them, and of course to Willie Villautin. So let's now leave the battle zone. Next week, we're focusing on crime with new novels set in Sweden and Barcelona. And after that, I'll be reporting on my trip last week to South Korea, the market focus country of this year's London Book Fair. So you see, we get around a bit. The only thing we need is yet more listeners around the world. Do tell your friends about us, get them to subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud, and make your comments as well on our website at www.theguardian.com/books. We have more on war issues in this week's Guardian Weekly. You can read about Oberndorf, the tiny German weapons manufacturing town that exports its firearms around the world. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, from me and producer Tim Mabey. Goodbye. And as we leave, here's a second song from Willie Villautin.
This song's called A Kid from Belmont Street, and I wrote a novel called Lean on Pete. The kid kind of started popping up, and this is the second song I wrote when I was just thinking about the kid all the time. This is A Kid from Belmont Street. Just a mixed up kid, and I know I've been there too. But you don't know what it means to get into a car. You don't know, just stay here.
You fit in somewhere and with someone. You just have to wait it out. Cause you don't know what it means to not trust anyone. It'll haunt you, it'll destroy you. Just a mixed up kid. Oh, I know. But I will help you out. I'll get you out of this.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.